listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Facelift by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Adam Friedlander. Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Mini Frosted Gold Quartz Watch. What do the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak, Patek Philippe Nautilus, and Omega Constellation have in common? All three, and many more, have showcased the genius of prolific watchmaker Gerard Genta. 25 years after its 1972 release, Audemars Piguet scaled down the Royal Oak to its smallest size ever for female clientele. Another quarter century later, this petite version offers a fresh interpretation for the modern woman. Clocking in around the size of a nickel, with a frosted gold finish, the textured metal sparkles without gems. Beauty, brains, and efficiency. My Stuff, Power Trip. President of Rosewood Hotels and Resorts, Radha Arora, travels in style with polished airport attire and vintage finds. Style file, summer suiting, Lauro Piana. Pocket square, Bruno Cucinelli makes the best pocket squares, and I have quite the collection. In the summertime, I will wear a nice silk square. To me, a pocket square completes an outfit, and I rarely ever go without one. Wrist candy, Audemars Piguet for a dress watch. Self-care, hand wash, Aesop Resurrection, cologne, Creed, Aventus. The scent is classic and fresh, with hints of ginger, sandalwood, and pink peppercorn. Daily vitamin, Perlel, and Erewhon. At home, recent addition, a pair of table lamps circa 1955. I have a passion for vintage lighting. During all of my travels, I make a point to source something. Fine china, Ginori, 1735. I have sets in green, yellow, and pink. Aroma, the Diptyque Bayes candle is a favorite. The Unexpected, artwork by Tony Rubino of Queen Elizabeth II, smoking a cigarette. At work, on my desk, a classic Mercedes model car from the 60s. To stay focused, I always keep my desk organized to keep from feeling overwhelmed. It is the same for my emails. I try to have a clean inbox. The menu, morning cup, I make myself an espresso at home using my La Marzocco machine. Pick me up homemade power bars with dried fruit and mixed nuts. Travel, airport outfit, a blazer, button-down shirt, and jeans. It's important to dress smart when traveling. You never know who you might see. Must have, my Bose headphones are the single most important item for travel. Carry-on, Bottega Veneta. Perfect stay, I'm dreaming of our next opening, Rosewood Schloss Fuschel outside of Salzburg, Austria. It's a fairy tale-like property from the 15th century, nestled on Lake Fuschel and surrounded by stunning mountains and forest. Pro tip, avoid checking luggage. in praise of alternate endings. After my dark decade, I reemerged in the public eye. What's happened since surprised me, by Monica Lewinsky. With opening photograph of Lewinsky by Ryan Pfluger. Never lose hope. I love you. Bye, Felicia. I texted my friend Katerina on October 27th, 2016. The sassy send-off had been in the culture for two decades, a reference from the film Friday. But it had only crossed our transom that year. We used it affectionately and therefore ironically. Unbeknownst to me, it would be our last text exchange. She died unexpectedly on November 1st. Our friendship had been a salvation in the latter half of what I now call my dark decade, roughly 2004 to 2014. Though that stretch of time included some moments of joy, they were few and far between. For the most part, I was in a sea of pain, coming to grips with what it meant to have been standing at the center of a political sex scandal in which I was opposing the most powerful man in the world. Coming to grips with the trauma that grew around me like weeds as a result of the public revelations of my private life, the ensuing media circus and impeachment trial. Coming to grips with what my future might look like. Answer, it looked effing bleak. I was unemployable, and I was angry. Katerina, an entrepreneur and activist, was whip-smart about current events, world history, and spiritual matters. She had a roaring, infectious laugh. She was also kind. You would hardly know that less than a decade earlier, in a freak accident, she had broken her back in five places. After being reassembled with metal rods, she was told she'd likely never walk again. Screw that, she would say, pun intended. She didn't lose hope, and instead insisted on an alternate ending, prognosis be damned. With grit and some luck, she recovered, and did indeed walk again. And she walked tall. Our conversations spanned the personal and the political. In 2013, as Edward Snowden leaked classified NSA documents exposing an array of methods the government and European allies used to spy on private citizens, Kat posited that 15 years earlier, the Starr Report had catapulted us all into what she termed the age of transparency. We'd had explosive disclosures in politics before. The Pentagon Papers, Watergate, Iran-Contra. But at their core, these were military, political, professional. 1998 was personal. A boss having an extramarital affair with a young subordinate. A politician abusing power. People under oath lying about sex. Rumors titillating the Beltway and beyond. All ordinaire, almost quotidian, but this time was different. As the truth was made public, published in full on the Internet, the personal behavior of a private citizen, me, along with the actions of others, which had typically been obfuscated by power, gender, status, and wealth, was laid bare. And this transparency led to historical and cultural shifts. Kat made the point that after 1998, for better or for worse, becoming transparent meant becoming seen in new and sometimes disturbing ways. And year upon year, we began to peek behind the veil in all facets of life and culture, thanks to the Patriot Act, reality television, the truth about weapons of mass destruction, the advent of social media, WikiLeaks, 23andMe, the UK tabloid phone hacking scandal, and on and on. Kat's argument was compelling, and a year after Snowden's data dump, 2014, I would find myself impacted by this age of transparency yet again, this time gratefully. Never lose hope. 10 years ago, after a decade of self-imposed silence in which I had retreated from a world that still shamed me, after a decade of involution and integration, and an F-ton of healing, I jumped back into the public conversation, with no safety net, and I found my voice by writing for this magazine. In many ways, my 2014 essay, Shame and Survival, was a social experiment. Vanity Fair and its then-editor, Graydon Carter, could have been lambasted for giving someone from a 15-year-old news story, well, 15 more minutes. And not just in a splashy interview, but in a first-person essay in which I allowed myself to be transparent and unblinking. The first line was, "How does it feel to be America's blowjob queen?" I was no longer mediated through another's gaze, but stepping forward unabashedly. And something surprising happened. A generation that hadn't lived through the brainwashing of 1998 insisted on reevaluating this story, one that, given government and judicial overreach, given the technological and tabloid explosion, had always been bigger than me and any one of the other players in it. It had always been a story about the culture at large, and why, in my original piece, I had referred to myself as a social canvas. What followed was a big fat effing miracle, trademark. My life changed, and I'll be forever thankful. That doesn't mean it has been all smooth sailing. Hardly. Over the years, I've spoken confidentially to many people who have been publicly shamed and have explained that taking back one's narrative doesn't happen overnight and is annoyingly replete with plenty of setbacks. While the essay went on to be nominated for a national magazine award, I'm not kidding, alongside pieces by Ta-Nehisi Coates and Roger Angel, Angel won. The following month, I attended a party in L.A., and a famous diva asked me, point blank, if I was someone's plus one. When I replied I had been invited, she snarked, "They just let everyone in tonight, didn't they?" "Yes, really." It went on like this. I gave my first major public speeches at the Forbes 30 Under 30 conference, and several months later, in 2015, at TED in Vancouver. But mere minutes after my TED talk, The Price of Shame, went online, the level of vitriol, misogyny, and hatred spewed at me in the comments section was worse than anything the TED team had experienced before. Who knew there were so many ways to say whore? Soon, I began working with anti-bullying organizations globally, and yet, when one of the groups was being honored at an event, I was asked not to walk the red carpet. In 2018, I was asked by Vanity Fair's newly appointed editor, Radhika Jones, to address the hashtag MeToo moment in an essay in which I unpacked my own thoughts about what constituted consent in a workplace relationship with a quintessential power differential. Shortly thereafter, I was disinvited to a philanthropy summit because former President Bill Clinton was a last-minute addition to the roster. I could go on for hours. If this last decade has shown me anything, it's that we never know what lurks or enlivens around the next corner. That one essay, where someone took a chance on me, helped set my life on a different course. My friend Katerina, who was intensely missed, was not as fortunate. One night, she had dined out with her husband and developed what became a fatal case of food poisoning. She was hospitalized, sepsis set in, and she quickly passed. But to this day, she remains seen in all her common majesty by everyone who encountered her in life. After all, in the end, what matters more than how it all began is how we have been seen. And as Rumi wrote, "Never lose hope, dear heart. Miracles swell in the invisible." Chicago Blues. On the eve of the Democratic Convention, Grant Park's past provides ominous echoes, by Douglas Brinkley. As the Democratic National Convention barrels down on Chicago this August, it's not lost on historians that Grant Park, stretched along the shores of Lake Michigan and the city's downtown loop, has been a kind of American omphalos, a venue for celebration, surely, but also a portal to the belly of the American beast. Born out of the ashes of the Great Fire of 1871, the 312-acre park was established three decades later, and its elegant promenades and groomed lawns soon became a people's playground, the site of both the Art Institute and Field Museum. During World War I, the traveling U.S. Government War Exposition held a highly attended spectacle there, with a display illustrating trench warfare, medical treatments, and new technologies. In my lifetime, two other gatherings in Grant Park, one not too unlike trench warfare, altered the trajectory of American history. The battle, of course, occurred in late August 1968, when the Democrats held their presidential nominating convention at Chicago's now-defunct International Amphitheater. At the height of the Vietnam War, the left was livid that incumbent President Lyndon Johnson had anointed a hawkish Vice President Hubert Humphrey as his successor. Running against Humphrey was Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota, a vocal war critic whose stance was echoed by some 10,000 anti-war activists who had swept into town to make their voices heard. The Yippies of the Youth International Party were there, along with the Black Panthers, the Students for a Democratic Society, the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, and others. Some had applied for permits to hold protest in the city's parks, and all but one had been denied. As delegates arrived in Chicago, the city's taxi drivers and electrical workers were on strike, hobbling transportation and communication. Some 12,000 police officers were on the streets, working 12-hour shifts, and Chicago's hardline mayor, Richard J. Daley, had called in the Illinois National Guard. On the eve of the convention, roughly 1,000 protesters descended on Lincoln Park, on the city's north side. Later, the police swarmed in, beating those who wouldn't leave the area. The New York Times reported that guardsmen had received instructions to address threats of tumult, riot, or mob disorder. As the convention got underway, tensions rose and violence flared in the streets and on the convention floor. Dan Rather of CBS News was assaulted on air by private security as he attempted to interview a delegate and warned that the Windy City was at a proverbial boiling point. On assignment for Esquire, counterculture writer William S. Burroughs was shocked by the police brutality. The lifetime photographer is laid out on bench medics washing his eyes out, he wrote. Outside, the cops prowl about like aroused tomcats. The only permit Daley granted was for those who assembled in Grant Park. As 15,000 came to hear anti-war leaders, including David Dellinger, Jerry Rubin, and Tom Hayden, police formed a cordon around the park, and armed guardsmen took up positions on the Field Museum's roof. The same day, convention delegates rejected McCarthy's anti-war plank and nominated Humphrey after demonstrators erupted in outrage. When a hippie climbed a Grant Park flagpole, cops responded with mace, tear gas, and nightsticks, clubbing activists unconscious. Activist Rennie Davis was one of those beaten, and the bloody rag used to clean his wounds was later hoisted up the flagpole. Protesters and press alike were pummeled as if for sport. The havoc was captured by TV news crews. First, NBC, then the other networks interrupted their convention coverage to air footage from the Battle of Michigan Avenue. The scene was a disaster for Democrats. From the convention, Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribicoff denounced Daley's Gestapo tactics, the mayor in the hall shouting at Ribicoff, calling him an effing kike. Out on the street, the tear gas was so thick, the clouds wafted into Humphrey's 29th floor suite at the Conrad Hilton. More than 90 million Americans watched Chicago unravel on TV, among them a gleeful Richard Nixon, who had accepted the Republican nomination just a few weeks before in Miami Beach. He immediately seized on a law and order message. Days later, he motorcaded through town like a reincarnated Douglas MacArthur come to liberate the city. In the photos, Grant Park gatherings, anti-war protesters, 1968, and a victorious Barack Obama amid supporters on election night, 2008. On election day, Nixon trounced Humphrey. A few months later, an investigative panel blamed the Chicago chaos on unrestrained and indiscriminate police violence, made all the more shocking because it was inflicted upon persons who had broken no law, disobeyed no order, made no threat. The Medical Committee for Human Rights reported that 425 peace activists were treated at its facilities. The college-age demonstrators were in part concerned about being drafted to fight in a war they were against. That's why Phil Oakes's defiant anti-war ballad, "I Ain't Marching Anymore," was sung with vehemence by the peaceniks. That August, he'd gone to Chicago at the McCarthy campaign's request to perform anti-war concerts. The experience rocked the troubadour to his core. As he would later observe, Chicago was just a total absolute police state, top to bottom. The following year, disillusioned by American politics, he released the album Rehearsals for Retirement with his own imagined tombstone on the cover. Its inscription, Phil Oakes, American, born El Paso, Texas, 1940, died Chicago, Illinois, 1968. In fact, Oakes hung himself in his sister's New York City apartment on April 9, 1976. Pope John Paul II arrived in white vestments in 1979 and held a papal mass in Grant Park, perhaps exorcising some of the site's violent stigma. Chicago's vast Roman Catholic community had shown up in droves the night before to hear the pontiff pray, "May God uplift humanity in this great city." Flash forward to November 4, 2008, Election Day. Barack Obama of Illinois, a local community organizer turned U.S. Senator, was poised to win the presidency. Projecting the audacious optimism that had fueled his unprecedented campaign, Obama had returned home to Chicago to vote. He watched the returns at the Hyatt Regency. When he was projected the winner at 11 p.m., the Secret Service whisked the president-elect to Grant Park, where 240,000 supporters waited. In his 2020 memoir, A Promised Land, Obama recalled the experience with awe. "I can see in my mind, even now, some of the faces looking up as I walked on stage, men and women and children of every race, some wealthy, some poor, some famous, and some not, some smiling ecstatically, others openly weeping. Jesse Jackson, who himself had run for the presidency, was in the crowd. I was crying," he would recount. "I thought about the moment, the movement, those who could not make it to Chicago, the people who had made that night possible. On that mild November evening, the promise of American democracy finally seemed at hand. A change is going to come," Obama said, evoking Chicago native Sam Cooke's 1964 civil rights hymnal. "That evening restored a bit of America's soul. Recently, I returned to Grant Park, with its skateboarders and couples holding hands. I just wandered. At the time, the nation's campuses were roiling with unrest over the plight of Palestinians in Gaza. A 1968 redux seemed highly possible, if not probable. I remembered how poet Allen Ginsberg, in a bid for calm amid the mayhem back then, had sat lotus-style, offering a melodious om. This August 19th through 22nd, the Democrats are holding their convention at the United Center. Fear of pro-Palestinian protesters flocking to Chicago has led to amped-up security. The difference between 68 and 24, however, is that the Secret Service and law enforcement, as they have at every other such convention since Daley's day, will prevent demonstrators from congregating near the site. It's unclear whether city permits will be issued for people to protest solely in Grant Park. But rest assured, if there are any flare-ups against police, any mistreated American flags, Donald Trump will instantly seize the law and order mantra, as Nixon did, in his efforts to reclaim the White House come November. The whole world will be watching. Scare tactics. My grandfather was jailed in McCarthy-era America. Political writers could suffer the same fate in a second Trump term. By Molly Jongfast. Opening illustration by Selena Pereira, which shows Trump's face superimposed on a McCarthy poster. On one of my near daily calls with my younger brother, who lives in Los Angeles, I mentioned my anxiety about November's election. and just maybe having to leave the country after it's all over. I might just want to have a small apartment in Canada or Mexico or something, just in case Trump comes back into power, I said. He scoffed, albeit in a very loving and gentle way. You know, the worst case would be something like what happened to Grandpa, he said, pausing. And you know, that kind of made his career. What happened to my grandpa, Howard Fast, is that his government deemed him a radical and in 1950 threw him in jail. Howard had been a best-selling novelist whose books like Citizen Tom Paine and Freedom Road explored race, class, and revolutionary ideals. During World War II, he did his part for the U.S. Office of War Information, writing and editing Voice of America broadcast. But where Howard went astray, at least in the eyes of Senator Joseph McCarthy and his fellow Redbaiters, was that he joined the Communist Party and refused to provide records of an anti-fascist organization to the House Un-American Activities Committee. This was a time of heightened fear and paranoia. Just months after McCarthy delivered his infamous Enemies from Within speech, in which he claimed to have a list of known communists working in the State Department. And since history rhymes, later McCarthy hired as his chief counsel Roy Cohn, who would go on to mentor a young Donald Trump. Howard spent 3 months at Mill Point Federal Prison, where he began what would be his best-known work, Spartacus. He was forced to self-publish because he was blacklisted, with his epic story of a slave uprising later immortalized on screen by actor Kirk Douglas and director Stanley Kubrick. So yes, Grandpa became much more famous after being jailed. When I recently spoke to my father, Jonathan, who is also a writer, he noted that Howard's appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee made him a household name. He was on the cover of the New York Times, said my father. A front-page Times headline from June 1950, 11 anti-fascists are sent to jail. Before that, he was famous. But after that... But it effed him up, right? I asked. I don't know, he responded. I think he found jail scary. Howard went on to write more than 80 books before dying in 2003, a year before The Apprentice would beam Cohn's Apprentice into the homes of millions of Americans, helping transform a cartoonish New York tabloid fixture into the image of a decisive business mogul and laying the groundwork for an unlikely path to the White House. Trump has made vengeance the cornerstone of his 2024 campaign. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution, he told a crowd in March 2023. I wrote for Vanity Fair at the time how dangerous Trump's behavior was, even as some pundits were writing off his chances of a comeback. He stepped up the menacing rhetoric in a Veterans Day speech. We will root out the communist, Marxist, fascist, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, that lie and steal and cheat on elections. They'll do anything, whether legally or illegally, to destroy America and to destroy the American dream, Trump said, later adding, the threat from outside forces is far less sinister, dangerous, and grave than the threat from within. I was already sure Trump would be terrible for democracy. We watched him sic a mob on the Capitol, after all, and that he had little regard for the rule of law. The latter was made even more clear during Trump's hush money trial in New York, where he was found guilty of 34 felony counts, not to mention Trump's continued demonizing of the media, also known as the enemy of the people, on Truth Social. But the November speech left me convinced that he would target his perceived domestic foes, with journalists among them. It's not like Trump and his allies are hiding anything. Kash Patel, a close Trump ally, expected to land a key national security role in a future administration, said in December on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast, we will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you, whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out. Now, whether I, a liberal writer, podcaster, and MSNBC commentator, would make such an enemies list remains to be seen, and for the record, my second son thinks I'm being hysterical. But it's certainly not out of the range of possibilities that visible members of the media, the types regularly warning against the dangers of Trump on social media and cable news shows, would be targets of a second administration hell-bent on revenge. I remember once, when I was young, asking my grandmother Betty about her husband's time in jail. Toward the end of Howard's sentence, she said, he started gardening, a peaceful image. She also told me how people used to throw rocks at her window during this period. Betty said that no one felt like heroes when all this was going on. She was raising two young children, and everything felt out of control. My grandmother wasn't a wildly dramatic person. I knew if she was saying that, it had to have been bad. Growing up, I was aware that my grandfather and mother, the feminist writer Erica Jong, were of a strange species of political novelist. Since I believe that a person's philosophical point of view has little meaning if it is not matched by being and action, I found myself willingly wed to an endless series of unpopular causes, Howard said in a 1972 interview. Experiences which I feel enriched my writing as much as they depleted other aspects of my life. My grandfather truly believed that his political work was the best thing he ever did, and took pride in his 1,100-page FBI profile for detailing every, or almost every, decent act I had performed in my life. If I were to seek some testament to leave to my grandchildren, proving that I had not lived a worthless existence, but had done my best to help and nourish the poor and oppressed, I could not do better than to leave them this FBI report. In those pages, there is no crime, no breaking of the law, no report of an evil act, an un-American act, an indecent act, and I was no paragon of virtue, and I did enough that I regret. But the lousy bits and pieces of my life are nowhere in those pages, only the decent and positive acts, speaking at meetings for housing, for trade unionism, for better government, for libertarianism, for a free press, for the right to assemble, for higher minimum wages, for equal justice for black and white, against lynching, against the creation of an underclass, against injustice wherever injustice was found, and for peace, and walking picket lines, and collecting signatures. Every time I read that paragraph, my eyes well up. My grandfather did what needed to be done. He was only in jail for 3 months, but it was hard on him. He once told us he was initially kept on death row. It was also hard on his loved ones. My father tells a story about Grandpa getting out of jail and the family feeling like America might no longer be for them. As a political dissenter, Howard was denied a U.S. passport, and the family lived for a while in Mexico, where you didn't need one, before returning to New York. In 1958, the Supreme Court ruled that the right to travel is a part of the liberty of which a citizen cannot be deprived. Many people suffered more than my grandfather. People killed themselves, went hungry, and were jailed for longer stretches. My grandfather ended up writing more bestsellers and living a great literary life. But the trauma of knowing your country could turn on you never abated. I hope Trump does not get elected for many reasons, from reproductive rights to the future of American democracy and the planet. But if he does, I will be brave, and that will be in no small part due to my grandfather's spirit residing somewhere inside of me. And if future President Trump does target his political and media adversaries, and I am one of them. I'll hire lawyers and write pieces and speak out. Like Grandpa, I'm no hero, just someone who does what needs to be done. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McCamus. Patti Smith, the musician, artist, and author on Coffee, Gerhard Richter, and The Temptation of a Fine Tweed. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Clarity when I am writing. What is your greatest fear? Collapse of the imagination. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A long-distance runner. What is your most treasured possession? My wedding ring, a plain gold band. What is your favorite journey? Entering the pages of a great book and gliding through the mind of the author. What is your greatest regret? Not spending more time with my mother, sitting in the kitchen, drinking coffee, and listening attentively to her stories. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My late husband Fred Sonic Smith remains the love of my life. When and where were you happiest? Tramping through the woods in South Jersey in 1957 with my dog Bambi. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Thomas Paine. Which living person do you most admire? The artist Gerhard Richter. What is your greatest extravagance? I love coats and don't need any more, but I am always tempted by a fine tweed. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I'm okay with what I've been dealt. Which talent would you most like to have? The ability to play piano like Nina Simone. What is your current state of mind? Concern for the displaced. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would love to have a better sense of physical balance. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? My brother Todd, who passed away at 42, would still be with us. What do you consider your greatest achievement? That I'm still alive and still working. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Feeling powerless to relieve the suffering of others. Where would you like to live? In the Rothko Chapel. What is your favorite occupation? My personal choice is writer. What do you most value in your friends? Intelligence and trustworthiness. Who are your favorite writers? I have too many to name, but my favorite living author is Cesar Aira. He's a genius. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Joseph necked the Magister Ludi in the glass bead game. Who are your heroes in real life? Those who spend the lion's share of their lives in service to others, such as Jimmy Carter, Ralph Nader, and Greta Thunberg. How would you like to die? With sound mind, able to express gratitude. What is your motto? Do good work. What is your most marked characteristic? Guts. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Patti Smith. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.